Welcome to another presentation of House of David Fellowship in Richmond, Virginia. I'm Lee Miller. We're going to continue with our series. We've been studying the book of Acts, and then we took a break and parked at Acts 15. Today, we're going to look at part 6. Of course, there's some A-B parts in there, too, so obviously there's more than just 6. But today, we're going to start another two parts within the part of the part. So, but, you know, that's what it takes. It was when you find a lot of material, you got to pull it together and present it. So today, part 6 is going to be entitled The Prophets. And what we're going to do is this assembly is going to become Acts 15. You'll understand it when we get there. So what's on tap? First, I'm going to do an intro to the prophets because James speaks about it in chapter 15, starting at 13b and going to 15. And we're going to look at what he says, and then we're going to do the assignment. And the reason we're going to do this is because God's done something, and we need to find it in the prophets. And if you remember the last thing that we finished, we were talking about the word translated for the first word of verse 21, and we went through numerous examples of how that word is used throughout the New Testament. And in most of the cases, I won't say all, but probably all, it was some decision has been made, and now I'm going to tell you why that decision was made. And through all, I think all of the examples I gave you, that was the case. And I would read a text, and then I would ask the question, why? And then the answer would come, for blah, 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 blah. So keep that in mind as we proceed. We know that God has done something. We've got to figure out what it is. So we're going to examine the prophets, and I'll tell you more as we get there. Now, if I had been at that Acts 15 meeting and I had been tasked with the responsibility of sorting this out, which is what you're going to do today, if I had been tasked with this mission, then what I would do is I'd break you up into individual small groups. And I would assign you different aspects. There's one question I have coming up that's going to deal with the Torah, but we won't deal with that right now. We'll deal with the writings and the prophets. Each one of you would be assigned a separate scroll, probably the Isaiah scroll, the Jeremiah scroll, the Daniel scroll, and then somebody else would get the 12. And you would go through there, and you would collect every statement that exists about the nations coming in. And if you're not sure about it, I don't care. Put it down. We'll deal with it later. But I want to know everything that's written in the text, because at the Acts 15 conference, Peter discussed the miracle that took place with Cornelius. And that's referred back to, and you will see that in the text that I'm going to show you. Then, Paul and Barnabas, they step up to the plate, and they start talking about all the miracles that are taking place. Well, let me just tell you something. I'm sorry, but miracles don't create halakhah. That's not how it works. You can only create halakha from the scriptures. And if you're going to set something into motion, you have to have the support of the scriptures. And that's exactly what I would task you people with. Tell me what the prophets have said. All right? So I would gather all the prophetic statements. Then the last subset group, whoever was left over, I would give you the Torah scroll, and I would task you with this mission. From the Torah, I want you to find called by his name. I want you to find the text, and I want you to explain to me from the Torah what it means when a people are called by his name. That would be the last group. So, there's your assignment. So, what are we going to do today? We're going to do exactly that. What did the prophet say? I'm going to present a report. Taking into consideration what the prophet said, and you'll see that as soon as you see what the prophet said, what is the definition of called by his name? Then as we continue, and as I said, today is it's part one of two, most likely, because I don't think I can go through this at the speed necessary to get it done. IAMCS is the International Alliance of Messianic Congregations and Synagogues. And they have a discussion concerning Acts 15, and we're going to look at it because we have to challenge what we think it says. And then next to that is First Fruits of Zion, they also have an understanding of Acts 15, and we're going to look at what they said, and we're going to let them challenge what we think the text says. I have all of their quotes and all of their references, so you'll be able to go follow up on this. Then, as we continue, we're going to look at biblical and pagan timekeeping systems in the Scriptures. And I'm going to show you at that time why that is so important to understanding James' decision. Then I'm going to ask you what happened in the first century. This time we have to go outside the Scriptures. We need to look at the history of what took place. And I'm going to quote the writings of early church fathers in the first century so that you can understand what they were thinking. Now, James didn't have that as his benefit. That's okay. Then we're going to have to look at the second century. We're going to talk mostly about Polycarp and Polycrates. You're familiar with both of those because we've covered them before. But we're going to reinforce the knowledge that we have looking back that James did not have, but it turns out, in my opinion, it aligns with what James decided. So, and then Colossians 2:16, I found an interesting note, was not looking for this, but when I was reading all the literature of IAMCS and FFOZ concerning Acts 15 to understand more clearly why they came to the decisions that they came to, they both chose Colossians 2:16 as their single source to support their decision as opposed to what I think the text says. So obviously, if that's their support, we're going to have to look at Colossians 2:16. So that's coming. And then at the end, the last thing that we're going to consider, there are several Greek words from the Septuagint that appear in the book of Acts, and these Septuagint Greek words correspond with particular Hebrew words that are directly related to Israel and are never used of anybody outside of Israel until we get to Acts. And then suddenly there's a change. And we're going to look at those Greek words so I can show you what I found, and we can evaluate that in the complete mix of what's going on. All right, let's get started. James answered, saying, "Men and brethren, stop speaking and listen to me. Simeon," that's Peter's Hebrew name, "had declared how God concerned himself about winning a people, taking a people for his name from among the nations. And to this agree the words of the prophets." So, here's how I saw this going down. Prior to this, James calls everybody together and says, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to find out what the prophet said. We know the miracle has taken place. You see that in verse 14, which is a reference back to when Peter gave his testimony of what happened with Cornelius. Everybody there, the apostles, the elders of the Jerusalem assembly, as well as the assembly itself, along with all of the other, I don't know what you call them, but leaders, you got the Pharisaic party that was against this position, all of those people are there, and there is a truth in this matter, and the truth is, you don't create halakha without a prophetic statement to support it. You just don't do it. There is no ifs, ands, or buts. And so everybody knows that what has to take place is we have to go find out what the prophets say. So, and I'm including the writings because there's some prophetic statements in the writings. So here we go. After this, this is what you guys would have reported back to me. Psalm 147:19. He issues his commands to Jacob, his statutes and judgments to Israel. He did not do so for any other nation. Of such judgments they know nothing. What do we remember about Micah 6:8? Three things that Yahweh requires of thee. What is the first one? Love, correct, judgments. Second one's love, hesed. But I put it, when I had the translation, I put the Hebrew word up, which is mishpat. So here is a situation that makes it perfectly clear. Israel received the statutes and the judgments. The rest of the world did not. We're going to revisit that. Psalm 18:43b, a people whom I have not known shall serve me. As soon as they hear, they obey me. Foreigners submit to me. Isaiah 5:26, he will lift up a signal flag to the nations from afar and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Behold, they shall come swiftly. Continuing Isaiah 55 verse 5, behold, you shall call nations that you know not, and nations that did not know you shall run to you. Isaiah 65 and 1, I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. I was found by those who do not seek me. To a nation that did not call on my name, I said, here am I, here am I. Continuing, change of topic for his name, Deuteronomy 14:2. Let's find out where we are, and who we are, and what it means. For thou art a holy people unto Yahweh thy God, and Yahweh hath chosen thee to be a peculiar people unto himself above all the nations that are upon the earth. Isaiah 63:19, we are yours from Olam, but you have not ruled over them. They have not been called by your name. Daniel 9:19, thy people are called by thy name. Amos 9:11, in that day I will raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, and will rebuild the ruins of it, and will set up the parts thereof that have been broken down, and will build it up as in days past. Verse 11. Verse 12 says, that the remnant of men and all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called may earnestly seek me. All right, let's talk about joining Yahweh. Let not the foreigner that hath joined himself to Yahweh speak, saying, Yahweh hath utterly separated me from his people. But it's the first part of this verse that's key for us. Let not the foreigner that has joined himself to Yahweh. Zechariah 2:11, and many nations shall be joined to Yahweh in that day. And they will also be my people. I will dwell in the midst of you all. Isaiah 2:2. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of Yahweh's temple shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. Verse 3. Many nations will go up and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh and to the temple of the God of Jacob. Wait, what? Many nations will say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh and to the temple of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us his way, we will walk in them, for out of Zion shall go forth Torah and the word of Yahweh out of Jerusalem. Just so you know this verse, here's 4. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. That's just a location hint. All right, continuing with what will happen? Isaiah 45:22, turn to me and you shall be saved. You that come from the ends of the earth. Isaiah 56:6. Also the foreigners who join themselves to Yahweh to serve him, to love the name of Yahweh, to be his servants, everyone that keeps the Sabbath and doesn't desecrate it and takes hold of my covenant. Oh, yes, we're talking about foreigners. Verse 7, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my temple. There, that's the foreigners' burnt offerings and the foreigners' sacrifices shall be accepted upon my altar. For my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. Now, this may sound familiar, but it's a different prophet. But in the last days, Yahweh's temple mount will be the most important mountain of all. It will be more prominent than all the others, and the nations will stream to it. Verse 2. And many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh and to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, we will walk in his paths, for the Torah shall go forth out of Zion and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. It's almost identical to the Isaiah prophecy. Ezekiel 36:25, I will sprinkle you with pure water, and you will be clean from all your impurities. I will purify you from all your idols. Now, just so we know what this is talking about, look at Hebrews 10. Let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with pure water. Obviously, many metaphors to be explored, just not today. Continuing with Ezekiel 36, verse 26, I will give you a new heart. I will put a new spirit within you. I will remove the heart of stone from your body, give you a heart of flesh. And 27, I will put my spirit within you and will cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will be careful to observe my judgments. But wait, isn't this prophecy for Israel? Guess we'll have to talk about that later too. Now, what's going to happen in the future? Just throwing a few more in there. Zechariah 14:16, and it shall come to pass that everyone that's left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, Yahweh of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. 17 and 18, don't go up, no rain for you. 19, this will be the punishment for all of the nations. Now, Ezekiel 44, thus says Yahweh Elohim, no foreigners, uncircumcised in heart, nor uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my temple, not even the foreigners who live among the Israelites. So, the question becomes, what does circumcised in heart mean? And what does circumcised in flesh mean? And now we've got foreigners living among the Israelites, and if they don't have both, they're not going into the temple. And yet, in a previous prophetic passage, it said that when they go into the temple, they will be given joy and their sacrifices will be accepted. This is in my new forthcoming book, Things That Make You Go, Zechariah 8:23, thus says Yahweh of hosts, in those days, 10 men from all the nations will grasp the garment of a Jew and say, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. And yes, I looked this up and it's not tzitzit. That's what I was going for. It wasn't there. All right. So this is the prophetic summary that you presented to me when I tasked you with this mission. Once the tabernacle of David is rebuilt, all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called may earnestly seek me. People from all nations will stream to Yahweh's temple. I bring them to my holy mountain and give them joy in my temple. They will say, he will teach us his ways. They will desire to go up to his temple of their own free will, to seek him with their whole heart. What does the song say? Both Isaiah and Micah. Come, let us go up. Excitement. Not, yo, dude, you're coming up. I don't want to hear anything. That's not what took place. This was out of their own heart. They'll say, we will walk in his paths. Wonder what those are. Foreigners will join themselves to Yahweh to serve him, to love the name of Yahweh, to keep the Sabbath and don't desecrate it. They take hold of my covenant. Their burnt offerings are accepted on my altar. Their sacrifices are accepted on my altar. This is what the prophet said. So when James says, this is what the prophet said, this is what the prophet said. Oh, let me repeat that again. What do the prophets say? This is what the prophet said. They'll seek Yahweh with a whole heart, wanting to hear him teach them his ways, desiring to walk in his paths, desiring to go to the temple, to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. They will keep the Sabbath and not desecrate it. And perhaps the most important aspect of a foreigner having their name called is this. They will take hold of the covenant. That's also in my new book. Now, the last of you guys that I called to do this, called by his name. Give me the answer. What is the definition in Torah? Well, let's read Deuteronomy 28, 9 and 10. Yahweh shall establish you. This is talking about Israel. Yahweh will establish you as a holy people unto himself, as he hath sworn unto you. Wait. This is a fun with math verse. If, then. Say after me. If, then. All right, here we go. If thou shalt keep the commandments and walk in his ways, then all of the nations of the earth shall see what? That you were called by the name. So the definition of called by the name is you're keeping the commandments and you're walking in his ways. If he's called you and you're doing those two things, then you've been called by his name. Now, here's the cool thing. All right. Now, I'm not going to pick on Gentiles because I was one, or maybe I still am. That's to be discussed later. I may have a Gentile complex. But anyway, I want you to look at what this verse is saying. Then all the nations of the earth shall see. So the first verse that we looked at, which I believe was in Psalms in the 140s, it said that statutes and judgments were given to Israel. Judgments were not given to the nations, and they are clueless. It's called clueless in the world. Okay, now, but they're not that clueless, because when they see Israel obeying the commandments and walking in Yahweh's ways, then they're going to say, oh, they're called by the name. I think that's good to know. All right, on deck. We know now what the prophets have said concerning what it looks like when those from the nations are called by Yahweh to become a people called by his name. We've seen that. We've seen what the prophets say. Now, what do IAMCS and FFOZ understand about this? First up, as I said, the International Alliance of Messianic Congregations and Synagogues. And this paper was published in 2014. It's entitled One Law, Two Sticks, Critical Look at the Hebrew Roots Movement. Now, Let me just say, as my opening disclaimer, I'm not claiming to be Hebrew roots. I am claiming to want to understand my Hebraic roots more clearly. But I, you know, want to make a differentiation here that I don't want to be pigeonholed incorrectly. Oh, man, he's interested in finding out about his Hebraic roots. That means he must be from the Hebrew roots movement, which means he believes A, B, C, D, and E. Not the case. So just want to make my position clear. Our purpose in this paper, everything here is a quote directly from IAMCS. By issuing this paper, we wish to identify and describe one law theology and the related Hebrew roots movement, both historically and today, and to give an informed opinion as to the errors as well as the inherent dangers of it. We in the Messianic Jewish movement also wish to make clear the fact that we are opposed to one law, that is, one law for Israel, one law for Gentiles that are called by his name. Let's make sure what we're talking about here. In our view, therefore, it is wrong to admonish Gentile believers universally to think that they need to observe the Torah. It is clear, furthermore, that the apostles dealt with this precise question of Gentile Torah observance and answered it on point in Acts 15. I say, can you make that case? The idea behind one law theology, whether stated or implied, is that he who keeps the law given to Israel, therefore is Israel. Now let me just say, when I read this week for the first time, I said, what? I had never heard of this in my life. Now I'm not saying that what they're saying is not true. I'm just saying I never heard this before in my life. So I'm just saying. Accordingly, one law theology is simply a form of replacement theology. That's a very scary phrase for me, considering my past. By keeping the laws which are specific to Israel, one thereby presumes to be Israel. See, I didn't know that. Just saying, didn't know that. This incorrect desire to keep Torah in order to become Israel is a deception that dates back to the time of the apostles. And I read this and I said, this is fantastic. They've given me two quotes, two passages that I can go right to. So let me share them with you. 1 Timothy 1:4. Neither give heed to myths and endless genealogies. Such things promote useless speculations rather than God's redemptive plan, which is by faith. And I thought to myself, incorrect desire to keep Torah is a deception, and this verse explains why. So I read this several times and didn't get any clarity. So there we are. Okay, what about Titus 3:9? Maybe better hopes hang there. But avoid foolish questions, genealogies, contentions. Disputes is really arguing about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. Now see, I know that debate about the law is good, but arguing about the law is unprofitable and worthless. So, back again. What question are we trying to answer? Incorrect desire to keep Torah of a Gentile who's been called is a deception, and this is why. Once again, I came up empty. We'll continue. By keeping the law, a person proves that they are Israel. This is the Hebrew roots premise. Once again, I did not know that. You know, it's funny, too, because I'm one of the editors on Wiki Encyclopedia. Did you read online? I'm an editor for Wiki. And I wrote a few years ago the main paper for Hebrew Roots on Wiki. And I didn't put this in. I didn't know this. Man. But furthermore, as opposed to the gospel of Scripture, which proclaims the good news of forgiveness of sin, the Hebrew Roots message is a gospel of law. For wit, to wit, that man is to be reconciled unto God, not by faith in God, but by keeping the law of Moses. Accordingly, no person can hope to be in a healthy relationship with God unless he or she is keeping the weekly Sabbath, the appointed feasts, and the dietary laws. All right, so now, we've got enough material here. How do they support this? The answer is, the scriptures testify otherwise. And they quote Colossians 2:16 as why what they have stated is true. We shall look at that to see if they have made their case. Why? Because Proverbs 18:17 requires us to do that. Continuing. In Hebrew Roots, the message is that God is supposedly angry at the Gentile church. Now that phrase, that confused me. Gentile church. Okay? God is angry at the Gentile church because the world, not the Gentile church, the world is eating the wrong foods, and because humans, that would be the world, are failing to gather on the correct appointed days. So then I was really confused, because all of the humans are not in the Gentile church, and the world is not the Gentile church. So whoever the Gentile church is, whoever that is, in Hebrew Roots, the message is God is angry at them because the world is eating the wrong food and humans are failing to correct to meet on days. I'm like, man, I am becoming so informed of all the stuff I did not know. The Hebrew Roots message to the Gentiles is that the reason Messiah died on the tree was not to deliver the Gentile from sin, but to deliver the Gentile from being a Gentile. As if being a Gentile would somehow be unacceptable to God. Talk about that a lot. The gospel message, therefore, for the Hebrew Roots enthusiast, is that God has sent his Son into the world in order to conform people to the image of a Jew. After all, Yeshua is Jewish, so all people must be like him. People that they list that support the message that people should be like Yeshua. They list Eddie Chumney, Bill Cloud, Brad Scott, Rico Cortez, the Hebraic Roots Network. They say all of these people believe that we should be conformed to the image of Yeshua. Yeah, and the problem is? All right, do not judge early. That's the wisdom of the prophets. FFOZ, Torah for Gentiles. At First Fruits of Zion, this is all quotes from First Fruits of Zion. The literature I took this from is listed at the end. It's PDFs. You can get them yourself. At First Fruits of Zion, we believe that the Torah is a source of spiritual blessing for Jewish and Gentile believers. I'm there. We encourage Gentile believers to take hold of the uniquely Jewish aspect of Torah observance, such as Sabbath, the festivals, the biblical dietary laws, as part of their walk of discipleship. However, we also acknowledge that the apostles did not require the Gentile believers to do so. They wrote to the Gentiles as follows, and then they quote the only four things that are required of Gentiles. They kept as much as they could, but they were not legally liable for certain Jewish distinctives, such as the commandments of circumcision, Sabbath, festivals, and Levitical dietary laws. And then I thought to myself, but wait, don't eat. What about don't eat anything that hasn't had the blood removed? Isn't that a Levitical dietary law? I always thought it was. That means that the God-fearing Gentiles could not be punished by the leadership of the Jewish community for failure to keep those particular commandments. Let me read that again. That means that the God-fearing Gentiles who are called by his name could not be punished by the leadership of the Jewish community for failure to keep those particular commandments because they were not legally under the law in the same way the Jewish people were. Please remember the phrase, leadership of the Jewish community. They'll learn the rest later. The apostles were simply offering the Gentiles four minimum standards for the sake of establishing fellowship within the Jewish community. After accepting those four standards, the Gentiles would learn about the rest of the Torah in the synagogue every Sabbath and start observing more of it. We talked about that because remember, after we did verse 1, we jumped straight to verse 21 to figure out what was taking place. Now, FFOZ goes on to quote David Stern to support their position. Let the Gentiles enter the Messianic community without becoming Jews. And don't be troubled over it, because no matter where these Gentile believers live, they will continue visiting the local synagogue and hearing what Judaism teaches about living a godly life. Sounded good to me. The Gentiles under discussion in Acts 15 were already on the trajectory of Torah. We saw that. We talked about it. Their presence in the synagogue on Sabbath indicate that they're already worshiping on the Sabbath. We talked about that. Their participation in the Jewish community indicates that they were already engaged in Torah life on some level and could be expected to continue to mature in it as they learned. What is there to disagree with here? As for their own halakhic authority over the Gentile believers, the apostles refused to lay anything on them beyond the four essentials of Acts 15. Anything beyond those four essentials. Now, what did the other text say? Leadership of the Jewish community, right? Let's read the rest of this quote. Anything beyond these four essentials, they left up to the leadership of the synagogues where the Gentile believers attended. So that means that when you come to my synagogue, Gentiles, you can keep the whole Torah. Is this what this is saying? It says that they have to be responsible to the leaders of the Jewish community. A leader of a Jewish community in a synagogue, not the president who runs the operation, but whoever's the leader. This says they're left up to the leadership of the synagogues for them to lay out for the Gentiles what they need to keep for that synagogue. I don't know. I'm a little concerned about that. You know, especially with how well all us leaders can agree with all these other leaders. I don't know. Got some questions about that. If the apostles intended for the Gentiles to eventually learn the Jewish particulars of Torah, such as circumcision, Sabbath, festivals, and Levitical dietary laws, and practice them, they never stated that expectation. Period. I added the word here because they didn't state it in Acts 15. And I say that's true. But, okay? Once again, don't eat anything that hasn't had the blood removed. Is that a Levitical dietary law or not? If it's not, tell me what kind of law it is. Nor did they offer a time frame for a Gentile in a believing synagogue to make the transition from non-observant to fully Torah observant. They said, that is Jewish. And that's when it hit me. Oh my, I just got it. What they were saying was, okay, start with these four. Then whatever synagogue you go to, Whatever the leader of that synagogue tells you you have to observe, that's what you have to observe. But if you end up observing the entire Torah, you are automatically a Jew. And I said, I didn't know that. I thought you had to go through a proselyte ceremony type thing to become Jewish. I didn't think you could just become Jewish by observing the Torah. This was news to me. But then, well, wait, I don't want to surprise you. I do want to surprise you. I don't want to give it away. I sensed a contradiction coming. They were silent regarding any specific plan for Gentile believers to eventually become obligated to the circumcision, the Sabbath, the festivals, and the dietary laws. They neither forbade the Gentiles from practicing the Jewish aspects of Torah, nor did they require them to do so. But now back to that Jewish question where I put in my own comment. They said Jewish and I put a line through it. The proof is in the prophets, which you guys just gave me the report of what they said. With this, the words of the prophets agree. First Fruits of Zion says, in what way does this passage justify a Gentile exemption from circumcision, conversion to Judaism, and full liability to the laws of Torah? How does that sentence equal that? Here's the answer. According to the Amos passage, the restored Davidic kingdom will include Gentiles who bear God's name. We saw that. Paul's Gentile believers fit the prophet's description well. They were Gentiles from the nations who identified themselves with God's name and sought after God because of the kingship of Yeshua. However, if the Gentiles who seek Yahweh through Yeshua must be circumcised to become legally Jewish, they cease to be Gentiles. All right. Let's reread it. If the Gentiles who seek Yahweh through Yeshua, must be circumcised to become legally Jewish, they cease to be Gentiles. Well, I agree, but the problem is that just because you observe all of Torah doesn't make you a Jew. It makes you a Torah-observant Gentile. If you have not gone through the proselyte, whatever it's called, then the Jewish community does not recognize you as a Jew. You could go over there with your list of every commandment that you kept and show it to them, and they'll say, that's really impressive. But have you become Jewish through the proselyte ceremony? No. Well, then you're not a Jew. That's what they're going to say. So this was really a surprise to me. How can you say that anybody who observes God's ways automatically becomes Jewish? Shocking. By virtue of the fact that Amos calls them Gentiles, who bear God's name, they cannot be Jews, nor can they be proselytes. The moment that such a Gentile legally converted to Judaism, they would become legally, which means halakhically, Jewish, and no longer be a Gentile who bore God's name. In that case, the believing Gentiles would fail to fulfill the prophecies because the prophecies clearly speak of these God-seekers as Gentiles. That's absolutely correct. You can't turn everybody into a Jew because they're what are the Gentiles called by my name. But if we allow these Gentiles to observe all of Torah, they become Jewish. Huh? I'm just telling you what I found. For the prophecy to be literally fulfilled, both Jews and Gentiles must exist in the days of Messiah, an impossibility if all Gentiles were forced to become legally Jewish. I agree. If we're going to have Gentiles called by his name, they can't be proselytes called by his name. Because proselytes are legally Jewish according to halakhic authorities in the Orthodox community. That's how it works. So I totally agree with this. But the point that I disagree with is, I think it's unfair based on what the prophets say. And what did they open the section with? The prophets agree. I think it's unfair to say that a Gentile that's called by his name, who come, let us go up, sacrifices in the temple, take hold of the covenant, won't desecrate the Sabbath, etc. I think it's wrong to say they're automatically Jewish. And I don't think you can find an Orthodox Halakhic authority who would agree with that position. Amos Gentiles are to be vassals of the Jewish king. As such, they are to be part of... What did we learn about Politeus? We looked at what Josephus said about it, what Philo said about it, what other writers of the first century said about it. We looked at what Paul said about it in Ephesians 2:11. They are, this is FFOZ, they are to be part of the politeus of Israel with rights as citizens of Israel. Okay? So far, so good. I'm with you. What's your next sentence? They are to be bound to the laws of the king of Israel. But what laws are they? Has Torah been done away with now? But wait, we just read the prophets and said, come, let us go up. Because the Torah is coming out of Zion. So, once again, I'm confused. The Gentiles, according to First Fruits of Zion, are to be bound to the laws of the king of Israel. They'll still be called Gentiles, but they're bound to the laws. My question is, which laws? We need to find out what laws are going to be enforced as the constitution of Israel in the millennial kingdom when the King Yeshua reigns. What laws are going to be enforced? Because that's the laws that the Gentiles have to be bound to. Okay, that's how I see it. They have a legitimate place in the kingdom and citizenship in Israel, but they still maintain their own non-Jewish legal identity. I'm okay with that. Don't call me a Jew. Let's pretend I keep all the commandments. I'm sure I don't. I err daily. But there is atonement. Person isn't sinless, they're blameless. That's what we shoot for. So I have rights as a citizen in Israel, but I'm a Gentile. Now what is confusing here is that in Paul's Ephesians 2 passage, starting at 11, he says you used to be Gentiles, but now you're not. But he was using the definition of Gentile as that you're an idol worshiper. If you're a Gentile and the fact that you're non-Jewish, and that's probably the better way to go here, what we should say is that there are two types of people in Israel. Jewish and non-Jewish. That's clear. Because we go to Romans 9:6, what does he say? Not everybody who is of Israel is of Israel. That's what he says. And so we've got to understand that with the restoration mentality. So here, if we just almost get rid of the word Gentiles, and I don't want to get rid of it completely, but I'm just saying, if we said non-Jewish people, then we might have something. So, all right, here's the two documents that I use to reference this. The first one is the Tipping Point, and the second one is Acts 15 Reexamined. So here is their preliminary conclusion. Observing all of Torah... Wait, what? Observing all of Torah does not make one halakhically Jewish, including circumcision. But over there, they said that if you keep all the commandments, then you're Jewish. But here it says if you keep all the commandments, you're not Jewish. So now I'm confused again. Converting to Judaism would cause them to become Jewish. Okay, I'm good with that. Anything beyond the four essentials in Acts 15, they left up to the leadership of the synagogues where the Gentile believers attended. You know, I never found that in the New Testament. I'm sorry, just never saw that. They didn't have a reference, okay? So, IAMCS, their support for their entire position is Colossians 2:16. Here's the slide. I bring it back here. Accordingly, no person can hope to be in a healthy relationship with God unless he or she is keeping the weekly Sabbath, the appointed festivals, and the dietary laws. And Colossians 2:16 makes that case. We will see. FFOZ, Colossians 2:16. Here are the documents they post. The title of the document is Why Is There No List? Here's two more documents that I associated. I studied just to see what they had to say. And this brings us to a position about how to interact within the Orthodox community. So I'm going to deal with Colossians 2:16 in part two, which will be in our next meeting. But before we finish today, I'm going to talk about 1 Corinthians 7:39, because this is a very important key, and I don't want to make an error here. So if you think that I'm making an error with my conclusion, you need to call me on this. But I'm going to tell you how I understand it. Here's the text. The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband is alive. But if her husband has died, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will. That's not the end of the verse. There's four more words. And the four more words contain the key phrase. They are only in the Lord. As I understand that text, that means that if two people are going to get married, a man and a woman are going to get married, both of them need to have made the claim that they believe Yeshua is the appointed one, the Messiah of Israel. That's how I understand this text. So if a woman has lost her husband and wants to remarry, she's free to do it. But only if she marries someone who's a believer. That's how I understand this text. All right? Continue. Now, how do I understand this text? Galatians 3:28. There's neither male nor female. So what does that make all of us, neuter? I'm not sure I'm buying that today. Okay? There's neither Jew nor Gentile. What? We're going to do away with that stuff? Bond nor free. For you're one in Messiah. You know what I think this means? It means that within the new priesthood that we're operating in, even as we operate in the old priesthood simultaneously, that in this priesthood, the role that you play is not decided by your descent or whether you are a free man or slave or whether you are male or female. That's what I think this text is saying. But this is Paul talking. There's neither Jew nor Gentile. This is going to lead into my understanding of 1 Corinthians 7:39. All right, this is from Judaism 101. Who is a Jew? Orthodox position. There's the path. The child that is born of a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father is a Jew. This is what they say. The child that's born of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother is not a Jew. So only if your mother is Jewish are you a Jew, according to the Orthodox community. Now, I'm taking this document at face value. I'm believing what they say. Okay? If you have a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. If you don't, you ain't. They quote Ezra 10, 2 and 3. But in my own mind, I countered that with Joseph. So this is something that could be explored at another time. I'm not going to explore it today. But this is the Orthodox position as they state it. Now, both agree that a Jew is fully obligated to the entire Torah and Gentiles are not. This is IAMCS and FFOZ. Both agree a Jew is fully obligated, a Gentile is not. So if a Jewish woman, here's the question, if a Jewish woman marries a Gentile man, they both believe in the Lord. That's the only requirement I understand in 1 Corinthians 7:39. A woman can marry a man as long as they both believe Yeshua is the Messiah. Of course, if I'm wrong there, then that creates a whole new path to go down. But let's pretend I'm correct there. So if a Jewish woman marries a Gentile man and they have children, according to Orthodox Judaism, the children are Jewish and fully and obligated to the entire Torah. This is what they say. Flip that. A Jewish man marries a Gentile woman, and they have children. According to Orthodox Judaism, these Gentile children have no obligation to the Torah whatsoever. All right, now, continuing. So, here is the question of the day. How can, in the situation of a mixed marriage, a Gentile father, who is only invited but not legally obligated to a Torah-obedient lifestyle, prepare his presumably Jewish children for a lifestyle of obligatory obedience to the requirements of the Torah in a credible and sustainable way? And what I mean by that is, over time, next generation, we have a Jewish woman, a Gentile man, they both believe Yeshua is the Messiah, they get married, they have kids. Tell me exactly what it looks like for this Gentile father to prepare his Jewish children for the full obligation of Torah they need to live. I need an answer to that question. Here's a text from a friend of mine, Jert ter Horst from the Netherlands. You can read more about this discussion. By the way, the Orthodox community, while they say this is legal, they say it's prohibited. Can't marry. A Jewish woman can't marry a Gentile man. And they quote Deuteronomy 7, 3 and 4 to support that position. So we have a halakhic difference in the New Testament because Paul says you can. He's a Pharisee. Not all the Pharisees agree with all halakha. Got great stories I could tell you about that, but another time. But what we do have here is they're saying this is not going to be allowed, so we don't have to be concerned about it. If only you knew the story of the conservative and reform movement as far as intermarriage. We will not go there. Okay, so aside from circumcision, though, the apostles provide no commandment, no list of commandments from which Gentile believers are exempt. Don't provide a list. Okay, so here is the closing remark for them. Perhaps Paul comes close to doing so in Colossians 2:16, where, notice this is the same passage that IAMCS quoted to support their position. FFOZ supports the same single verse. They say, perhaps Paul comes closest to providing a list of commandments you don't have to keep, where he lists the Sabbath, the festivals, the new moons, the dietary laws. In this passage in Colossians 2:16, and FFOZ's position is, as matters for which the Gentile believers should not be judged. We are going to test that in part two. Their statement is, he only says that Gentile believers are to be judged according those matters. A statement that could not be made if there were Jewish believers in Colossae. We are going to pick this apart like a good chicken bone. Okay? All right. That concludes this presentation. This is part one of two. We will come back for the rest of what was on tap. Thank you. I will take questions now.